Welcome to Sports Weekly with Ayaz Memon.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Sports Weekly with Ayaz Memon. We've got a lot to cover today. It starts with cricket in South Africa, in New Zealand, in Australia. It's all in the Southern Hemisphere, as you noticed. Then we've got tennis, more from the Southern Hemisphere, but this is more of a saga than a sporting story. We'll also be joined by Saumil, who'll take us through the world of football and Formula One. But before we go down there, let's welcome Ayaz to the show. Hi, Ayaz.
Hello, Mr. Fantastic. It's a pleasure always to be on the show. And my God, what a, there's so much happening in the world of sport. You mentioned about the cricket and there's, terrific action going on. Not just because of some upset results, some, unexpected draws. But I think more significant at this point in time, or as significant, is what's happening in the World Test Championship points table. There's been tumult there, especially with Bangladesh beating New Zealand in the first test in New Zealand. So the lion being tamed in its own den, so to speak. And then, of course, England drawing the Sydney Test match. What a terrific climax to that match. And then the big one for us, at least, coming up at Cape Town, which is India versus South Africa. And the series is on a knife's edge, as we know. So there's lots at stake for these six teams that are engaged in these series. But there is the Djokovic saga. I'm just trying to jog my memory as to where something as newsworthy, as controversial, as polarizing has happened in any sport. And, yes, there are issues of the black fist protest in the 1968 Olympics, and then there's Muhammad Ali's tribulations against the US government, etc., etc. But this is out of that same, it's of similar import and impact. Novak Djokovic, even as a tennis player, had polarized the world, and now increasingly it has become, it's become a political slugfest between Serbia and Australia, and the tennis world itself is so divided. So I think this has been an action-packed week. Yes,
absolutely. And you just mentioned the World Test Championship table, and it's a funny-looking table right now. We've got Sri Lanka leading it, with Australia and Pakistan in second and third, followed by India, South Africa, Bangladesh, and the reigning world champions are sitting eighth, just a shade above England.
Yeah, the New Zealand, team, they've been through a harrowing time to be beaten by Bangladesh, and I must say that it gave me great joy to watch that match and, keep updating myself, because it's one of the great upsets in the history of cricket. Bangladesh, they've got such a poor record playing anywhere away from home. And they were without some of their best players. Saqib al-Hasan not there. Mustafizur Rahman not there. Tamim Iqbal not there. So, it looked like they were lambs to the slaughter. But hey, on a typical New Zealand Kiwi pitch, green top, where New Zealand hardly ever lose to anybody. They had to eat humble pie. And, they had this young, not so young, but he's a character in himself, Ibadat, the fast bowler who's from the Bangladesh Air Force, who was actually a volleyball player who'd become a cricketer. What a story. And he picked up six wickets, turned the test match on its head. And New Zealand, unbelievably for them, after showing the heroics of drawing a match in Kanpur, which looked lost for them, they came here and they were beaten in their own lair. It was one of the remarkable upsets in Test cricket history. You have to go a long way back to think of when such matches have happened. And featuring such a unconsidered team, unfancied team like Bangladesh. So this has been a great result. But I must say, as we talk, New Zealand have come storming back into contention. It's a two-match series. And in the second test match, they made 500 plus at a very rapid pace, and they've reduced Bangladesh to 84 for 6, something that I was watching the match a little earlier. I couldn't see till the end, but it's about 6 wickets lost. So this is a match where New Zealand have come completely prepared to overwhelm Bangladesh so that they don't lose the series. Because imagine if you lose a home series, what it does to your status in the points table. It severely damages it. As you mentioned, they're already at number 8. So it's not a happy situation for New Zealand at all. They seriously have to win this match to start their climb up back again.
Absolutely. And well, they're well on the way. They posted 521 for 6 declared in the first innings, led very, very strongly by a 250 by Tom Latham. and 100 by Devin Conway. So normal service has resumed, you'd assume, because Bangladesh, as we speak, are struggling at 106 for six.
Yeah, it's become 106 for six. So there's been some recovery. I think at one stage they were 24 for five. So there's been some recovery, but it's far away from New Zealand's total now. And the other, you know, one, you know, kind of somewhat melodramatic touch to this match is Ross Taylor. This is Ross Taylor's last match for New Zealand. He retires after this test match. He's been a terrific performer for New Zealand. He's averaging over 44. I don't know whether he'll get a second innings in this match. Unlikely, given the first inning score that New Zealand have posted. But it must be acknowledged, his contribution. These are the players who hold up the sport in their own country. Remember, New Zealand doesn't have a massive talent pool. In fact, they've become a formidable team now because guys like Ross Taylor have still been around. He's been playing for 18 years or 19 years. And he's been one of the pillars of New Zealand cricket. And I think he's got a terrific farewell also. I think he got a guard of honor from the Bangladesh team, which was very sporting of them, very nice gesture. Yeah, so New Zealand will be hoping that they give Ross Taylor a winning send-off.
Absolutely. Well, let's hope that that story ends well. Going back to the India-South Africa second test match, after the huge win in the first test, it seemed like the stage was set for India to run through South Africa in the second test. But what do you make of the pitch to start with? I mean, it was definitely an up and down pitch. The match ended on day four and only delay really was rain. So do you think the Indians read this wrong or did just South Africa show more resolve?
Well, South Africa certainly showed resolve and it was exemplified best by Dean Elgar's unbeaten 96 in the second innings, which took his team to victory. It was against all odds, let me tell you that, because 240 was more than what South Africa had scored in their first innings. And 240 for three, so it's a thumping win in the circumstances. There was a lot which was still happening in the pitch. I think, Mr. Fantastic, that India were, I won't say callous, I won't say casual, but they missed, you know, they missed opportunities to take a stranglehold on the game. They missed it while batting, especially when Rahane and Pujara put on a sparkling century partnership. Both got half centuries. And then we saw a sudden collapse and wickets fell, most damagingly of Rishabh Pant, the way he got out. And then on the last day also, on the fourth day that is, in the 2.5 hours play possible, I thought the bowlers looked overwhelmed by the demands of the situation. And even guys like Bumrah, and I mean, why Shami wasn't brought on from the start beats my understanding. But the length they bowled wasn't really what was needed on that pitch. Whenever they hit the right spot, they got a wicket. Like Shami picked up a wicket and Thakur picked up a wicket. But otherwise, I thought they were trying to hustle the South African batsmen into mistakes, bowling short, which actually allowed the batsmen to, you know, play a little more freely. Growing up on those kind of pitches, batsmen, however weak the team and inexperienced the team, they are used to playing strokes with a horizontal bat. You know, the cut, the pull, the flick to square leg or fine leg, and which is how they got the run. Anyway, Dean Elgar led from the front with a tremendous show of courage and grit. He got hit on the body several times, even on the third evening. But he took it all in his stride. And that's the kind of inspiration which is so necessary in a young team of batsmen. I thought that they've got some very good players, South Africa, without the experience, of course, to match.
I think Keegan Peterson looks like one for the future.
You took the words out of my mouth. He's a class act. You know, he's a touch player. He's got so much time to play his strokes. And what marks out batsmen as special talent is the way he finds the gaps. So he's not thumping the ball, he's caressing the ball. But he's a good reader of line and length. And I think Themba Bavuma has been the most consistent player for South Africa in this series. So he's another one who's come good. The South African bowling has come very good in this match. They've got Juan Olivier, who's added an extra edge to their bowling. But the spell put in by Rabada, that was transformational in the context of the match. When it seemed like, you know, that India would run away by notching up a score which would be in excess of 300. He just turned things around in a brilliant hostile spell, aided, I think, by some reckless batting by India. And that gave South Africa the opportunity and the self-belief that they could still win the match. And that's what they did.
Well, what do you make of Shardul Thakur's spells? A 7 for is an amazing achievement. and on a pitch where your frontline bowlers were actually having no impact.
Yeah, I mean, without Shardul, India was sunk, isn't it? I mean, it would have been sunk very badly. So a 7-wicket haul by any yardstick is a tremendous achievement. And what I like about Shardul is that he's a 120% guy. When he gets down onto the field, he bowls his heart out. We all know he's not as gifted as a Bumrah or a Shami, but he's no less hardworking and he's no less aggressive. He's always looking to do something extra and to try and get wickets, which is what, and you know, I call him the man with the golden arm, but you don't get 7 wickets with the golden arm, but you also have to have talent. He's got, you know, the ability to swing the ball late, especially away from the batsman. He's a very clever bowler. He's a very hardworking bowler and he's a very clever bowler because he's got very rich experience in first-class cricket in India. He's come up the hard way. He's a late bloomer. He's got a chance belatedly and he's making the most of it. And when he bats also, he's trying to give you something, give the team something which is of value. And I think that's really why, in my opinion, if I have to select a team tomorrow for tomorrow's team, amongst my top three picks would be Shardul Thakur. I can't think of India playing a match without him now, especially overseas, but even at home as the third or the fourth seamer, because he just brings so much to the table.
Absolutely. And now that you've brought up the topic of the third test, it's going to be a tricky selection, you know. Virat Kohli should be back, which makes him captain, of course. But who sits out? Will Hanuma Vihari suffer again, or will those two second inning 50s save the old hands of Cheteshwar Pujara and Ajinkya Rahane? Or do you think there's value in India going in with one less bowler, given how badly the middle order has been performing?
It's a vexing situation for Rahul Dravid and for Virat Kohli. I'm sure Virat is coming back. And from the visuals that have been coming from Cape Town and what I've seen, actually, Ridhiman Saha went through an extended session of wicket-keeping. So, is that going to be one more change? Is Rishabh Pant going to be replaced? Is that punishment for the reckless shot he played? If it's punishment, I think it may be a little harsh because he's a young fellow and he's done so well in the past year, year and a half. And maybe he needs to be mentored and told where he went wrong rather than wrong. But that's, I'm just speculating. But the big issue is, of course, when Virat comes in, who goes out? And it would be a travesty, in my opinion, if Hanuma Vihari goes out. In the previous match, he didn't make a half century. Pujara and Rahane made half centuries and sparkling ones, as I mentioned. But the most solid batsman from India was Hanuma Vihari. In fact, even in the first innings, till he got a snorter from Rabada. You know, he's done nothing wrong for a year and a half, but he keeps getting bumped off from the playing 11. Even in the original squad, he wasn't part of it for some strange reason. And he was sent on the India A team, but also he did well in the same country. So he's familiar with South African conditions. He's been getting runs there. He's looked extremely good in the Centurion match. And I don't see why he should be dropped. Unless, of course, it's just for the fact that the series is level and Rahane and Pujara have loads of experience, 90-plus test matches for Pujara, 80-plus for Rahane. But is that good enough to drop Hanuma Vihari? I personally think not. Now then, the choice is between Pujara and Rahane, which I leave to Rahul Dravid and to Virat Kohli. But I would also say or argue that at this point in time, there could be a thought, let's play with four specialist bowlers and beef up the batting a bit. But that might be, you know, a signal to the South Africans that the Indian team has become defensive. You know, against this South African batting team, frankly, you should be, you know, dominating them. I mean, that should be attempted by five bowlers to show, you know, to create a psychological impact. Obviously, what you do on the field also matters. So I think, you know, the five bowler strategy would still work for me. Of course, Mohammad Siraj, if he's not fit, will have to be replaced by either Ishant or Umesh Yadav. In my opinion, Umesh Yadav, I would prefer because he also brings a little more into the batting. He's a better fielder. But Ishant, of course, has also been a very useful and very rich in experience. So these are choices that have to be made by Rahul Dravid and Virat Kohli. But really, the issue for me is that if India go back from here without winning the series, even a drawn series, it's a setback. And it'll be a setback for individually for players concerned because they haven't been able to do too well. And certainly also for Virat Kohli as captain. He needs to get runs in the last match. But he also needs to win the match as captain because that will keep the skeptics at bay. Otherwise, there will be more and more, you know, noise around or surrounding his batting as well as his captaincy.
How much do you think will his own form be weighing on his mind right now? Given, and we spoke about this last week, that it's not bad numbers-wise. But as Virat Kohli, you expect him to be doing far more.
Of course, and it's just gone on for, you know, it's just been so protracted, this lean spell, as we call it. So he's been getting the 30s and 40s in the previous match. The first match that he played, he got 35 and 18. So he got starts in both the innings. What's happening with Virat is that he's getting the starts and then he's getting out through a momentary lapse in concentration. But what is kind of bugging Virat himself is that his manner of dismissal, there seems to be a sense of deja vu about it, because match after match after match, he's getting out in exactly the same fashion, which is chasing the ball outside the off stump from the seventh or eighth stump and, you know, getting caught in the slip cordon or behind the wickets. Now, I think that he needs to, you know, yes, of course, the century is awaited and that will be playing on his mind. But I think he needs to play a match-winning knock. That's what is important from this, you know, from his point of view and from the team's point of view. What do I mean by match-winning knock? When you look at the previous test match at Johannesburg, Rahane and Pujara looked set for, you know, they put on 100+, both made 50s. Neither went on to play a match-winning knock. So they may have played a knock which was good enough perhaps to save their places in the team, but it didn't help the team win the match. So if it's a very low-scoring match and if Virat makes a 50 or a 60 and it helps India win the match, that's worth more than 100. You know, it depends on how the pitch plays out. But if it's a reasonably good pitch, scores of 300, 350 are possible, and you make 30, 35, and you don't end up helping the team win, that's not a match-winning performance. And that's something that Virat needs to contribute now in both capacities, as a batsman and as a captain.
Absolutely. Well, let's hope that the Indian team is really able to bring back what's expected of them, which is a series win from South Africa. Moving on and staying in the Southern Hemisphere, we've got the fourth Ashes test to talk about. And boy, was that a close run affair. How well did Jimmy Anderson bat for those last six balls?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's got the statistics that I got to hear about is that 102 times he's been not out. 103 now. He's gone ahead of 102. So he finds himself in these situations quite often, which is why he's strong of nerve and self-belief, because he thinks he can, you know, bat out the 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 deliveries or 10 minutes that are remaining. But hey, what a great and gripping, you know, final session for the match and for test cricket lovers all over. So it's not always that a match has to be decided or get a result to be gripping and entertaining and, you know, engaging. Sometimes a drawn match can be as engaging, edge of the seat excitement. The question, of course, which will be asked is, did Pat Cummins delay the declaration? Considering that England had been routed in the earlier test matches, why would you know, extend it and not give yourself that little extra chance? But these are questions that will always pop up when you fail by one wicket to win a test match. You know, I mean, so I won't be too harsh on Pat Cummins. Remember also there was some time lost because of rain. But England, of course, have saved themselves the ignominy of a whitewash or a clean sweep with weather being inclement even in Hobart, where the last match is going to be played. Maybe they'll go back 3-0. Now, it's not just about saving the whitewash. It's also getting points. If a match is drawn, you get points in the WTC table. And Australia will, you know, if you don't win all your or most of your home matches, then you start suffering in the points table later on when you start touring. So these are, you know, the ramifications of matches today, test matches, because of the WTC 2-year cycle has been even more engaging. And the other thing which I want to, we've talked about whether Vihari should be in the team or Pujara or, you know, look at Usman Khawaja. He made 200s in the Sydney match, 100 in both innings. And at the end of the match, he said he wasn't sure whether he'll play the fifth test match because Travis Head is coming back. So that's how that's how tough it can be for some players. But I personally think Usman Khawaja should play because he must play. You can't drop a player who's taken, who's got two centuries. I say that with some reservation because remember, Ajaz Patel was dropped after taking 10 wickets in an innings. So all kinds of things are happening in Test cricket currently, Mr. Fantastic. I think that Marcus Harris, unfortunately, may have to be the guy to be left out, and either most likely that Head will open with Warner and Khawaja will bat in the middle order where he's been so prolific in the last match.
No, it's quite a unique situation there where you might have a double centurion or a two centurion guy from a Test match miss out altogether. But what do you think the fifth test will throw up? Will it be 4-0, weather permitting?
I mean, look, England, the contrast has been stark. You know, I mean, England just don't look like a test team. They've had some good performances in Sydney. Ben Stokes getting 2 half-centuries. Johnny Bairstow getting a century. And finally, you know, England's batting showing some spunk, if I may put it that way. But they've got so many problems at the top of the order. Haseeb Hameed can't get going. Joe Root had a poor match. Even David Malan, who had got runs in the earlier matches, some matches, just not looking good enough for runs. So Butler has got has been out of form and also got injured now. And, you know, even the bowling, I mean, a fifer for Stuart Broad was fantastic, and it vindicated his own self-belief that he can do wonders in this Ashes. James Anderson bowling well, but not able to pick up too many wickets. And now he must be flagging because, you know, it's a tough tour. And he's played the last 3 matches. So whether he'll, I think he should be retained. He and Broad make a very good combination, not just with the bat, but more specifically with the ball. But overall, it looks like a gross mismatch to me. Look at the batting lineup that Australia have today with Khwaja and amongst the runs, Labuschagne, even Cameron Green, Steve Smith, David Warner, and then the bowling attack is just looks overwhelmingly good for me for England to make a comeback and try and win a match. It just looks, well, nothing is impossible in sport, but it is improbable.
Absolutely. Well, let's hope that England are able to make a match of it and at least come back with a single victory.
So, yes, let's go over to the whole Novak Djokovic saga, or Novaks, or many other names as it's been called. We could make light of it, but it's a serious issue. I mean, this is the world number one tennis player, and he's being shunted about like he's a nobody, he's a criminal, and he's entered Australia illegally or something by the looks of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a mess. And as you mentioned, he's the world's leading player. Everybody knows him across the globe. And you don't deal with such people in such a unconsidered manner. Let's put it this way. And I'm just going to quote what Judge Anthony Kelly, who, you know, ruled in his favor, was saying, that it was an unreasonable way of putting a ban on him after he had been cleared and he had been given exemption by the, you know, by the Australian Open tennis authorities. So there is obviously this situation to consider, that why did they allow him the exemption if they were going to have all this drama later? Obviously, there is a lot of politics being played out, Mr. Fantastic. There's politics between Serbia and Australia that's happened after the Djokovic saga began. There's also the internal politics in Australia. So there is the state of Victoria, which virtually clears him to come and play, and the Australian Open is played in Melbourne, while the Australian central government authorities have stepped in and said, no, he can't. As yet, we don't know whether he can play or not. Remember, he may still be deported, and that can get worse for Djokovic, because he could be banned for 3 years from entering Australia. So it's a bit of an imbroglio into which Novak has also got kind of maybe willingly got stuck into it, and it's divided the tennis world. Lots of tennis players are unhappy. There were stories about him having got COVID in the month of December, I think. And then he moved around with kids. There were pictures of him emerging and talking to children and stuff like that. That hasn't gone down too well with the tennis fraternity. The other larger issue also is, which is emerging, is that the management or the handling of COVID differs starkly from country to country. So if he, you know, does get to play in the Aussie Open, what happens when the next tournament comes up, which is in Paris, when the next Grand Slam in France, and then after that in England? How will the authorities view this situation? Because if Novak is a no-vaxxer, you know, he's got a no-vax policy or a self-belief, then what happens to his future participation in Grand Slam? So these are all issues that are being thrown up. And I think that right now, all I can say is that the world of tennis is in a right royal mess. And so is the, you know, the Australian political scenario, with the state of Victoria seemingly ranged against the government of Australia. And obviously, Novak Djokovic right now, he seems to be taking it on, you know, head on, because he started training. He spent his period of isolation and virtually in house arrest. He's withstood all that. It's created a furor, not just in Serbia, but also in Melbourne, where Djokovic supporters are out on the streets and are protesting against his the way he's being, in a way, in a sense, what they believe is he's being kicked around like a football. And who can blame them for thinking like that? I think this whole issue has become a bedlam, frankly.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two questions here which I want to ask you. One is, as a leading global figure, do you think it's his responsibility, in given the times we live in, to kind of not promote the no vaccination part?
Well, I don't think it's right on his part to actively promote this, you know, in the sense to say, I'm a no-vaxxer and I can go and play wherever I want. It's like up to you all, like it or lump it. I think that's a very harsh and unreasonable stand to take in this time of the epidemic. He could be, you know, obviously that's his personal belief, so he can live by it. But to proactively, in a sense, go and say that, you know, vaccine is not so important as it emerges, that is the message one gets from his approach. That, I think, is not a fair situation, because he's such an influential person. He's not just any ordinary Joe. He's Novak Djokovic, the world's number one player. And there's a legion of people who follow, right from the way he plays his strokes. They emulate him in tennis. They emulate his diet. And therefore, they also start emulating his belief about Novak, not taking any vaccination. So that, I think, is an unfair situation.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, you've seen a lot of other global figures, leading figures, who are very strongly promoting this. I think it's callous, to be very honest. The other main question that now props up is, if he did play in the tournament, where does that sort of leave the whole law of the land? And I don't think Australian public at large likes queue jumpers, as they call them. And how does that kind of fit in with the persona that Novak has very actively tried to pursue, which is one that he wants to be loved the way Rafa and Roger are, and he isn't, and whatever he's doing right now doesn't help.
Yeah, it does help. I don't think he's going to get too many brownie points for his stand. I also think his own persistence or insistence on being allowed to play without taking vaccination is leading to a huge amount of political turmoil in Australia. So ultimately, it's, you know, in a sense, it's Australia fighting against Australia or with itself. That's what is emerging. What I still fail to understand is why all the Grand Slam, you know, tournaments, the administrators can't take a united or a unified call vis-a-vis allowing players to participate with or without vaccination. I know that this is subject to the laws of the land also. So, for instance, there might be a situation where there is a massive wave in, say, Australia of COVID, or in the US or in England or in France, but not in other countries. It may not happen all simultaneously. And therefore, a country which looks completely safe at a point in time and another looks completely unsafe may take different positions. But I think, given the global impact of COVID on the human race, I just wonder whether the Grand Slam committees are just being a little too democratic or too considerate in each one trying to play its own number on the situation rather than taking a joint stand. And that would help matters, because if all the four Grand Slam tournaments decide that we want all people with vaccination, or we don't mind those who come without vaccination, then the position becomes clear. And then, therefore, you know, it's a slightly different situation. Of course, I think it's still not an easy way out, because the policies or the politics of each country can't be kind of reined in by just one, you know, unidimensional fiat or a diktat. So it's a very complicated case. And I can only say this in my position would be that this is not working out too well for tennis, for Djokovic himself, and certainly not for the Australian government.
Well, let's hope they're able to resolve this amicably and that the tournament does happen. But to be very honest, it'll be very disappointing to see Novak actually play in this tournament, given all that has transpired.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Mr. Fantastic.
Hey, Mr. Fantastic. It's so great to be back here on Sports Weekly. And transfers, that's the biggest subject that we have for you today in terms of football. And now This will make things very interesting because the January transfer window usually does not quite have the biggest of moves taking place. And naturally, the same is represented this time out as well. But there are a couple of big stories that I think are worth taking note of. And the first one happens in Spain, happens with Barcelona, where Ferran Torres, Manchester City's really AC striker, if one may call him that way. He's very smart in the way he plays. He's actually joined Barcelona, but they had a bit of a problem, which has only just been solved, actually. Ferran Torres joined the team, but was unable to get registered because the age-old problem of Barcelona's wage bill being far too high in comparison to their revenues. And so La Liga had a bit of an issue registering him in. But it took Philip Coutinho to go to Aston Villa on loan so that the team had enough wage budget available to accommodate Ferran Torres. That's how crazy it got eventually. And Torres is a part of Barcelona now. He's nearing a return after an injury to himself. And the interesting part is poor management by Barcelona again. They just got a player for 55 million and didn't even have the space to accommodate him. They were hoping that Coutinho would be able to go, and Coutinho has been able to go, which is another big story, by the way. How Philip Coutinho has declined so dramatically in the last few years after being the subject of a very costly transfer between himself, between Liverpool and Barcelona. And now since then, he's been on loan to Bayern. He's been neglected in the Barcelona team, and he's found his way to Aston Villa. Very similar, essentially, to what happened to James Rodriguez in a way. So, bit of a shame to see these two playmakers dwindling in the prime of their careers. But hey, that is exactly what happens sometimes, right? You really can't help it. And let's just hope that things get better for them in the long run. But other notable transfers, Kieran Trippier has moved from Atletico Madrid to Newcastle. Now, you might be scratching your head saying, why would he do that? He's a world-class player. He can perform at the highest level for any top six Premier League club. Why Newcastle? Well, if you remember, Newcastle has been taken over by the Saudis, and that is turning out to be their first big showcase of confidence, in a way, that they've got the money in the bag and they can pick out and pluck out those world-class players for themselves. So Trippier could be the first of a new generation coming to Newcastle. One has to wait and watch to see how things are going to flow out that way. But apart from that, news is a little bit bleak if you're a Tottenham Hotspur fan. Tanguy Ndombele might end up leaving the club, and that's turning out to be a big story that's happening right there, with Ndombele not quite very happy, and Spurs also keen to let him go. And apart from that, it's really even worse because Steven Bergwijn might also be sold by Tottenham. And his loss, it's not hurting Tottenham right now as much because he's only played four times since Antonio Conte has arrived in the club. But he's a very effective player to have on your bench to make an impact. And Tottenham, they're certainly looking for a replacement if they are willing to sell him off. So something is going on over there at Tottenham. But that's the transfers in January. And there could be a few more coming in the way. There's still a couple of weeks left for the window. But the intriguing part is, how does this impact the Premier League? Well, Romelu Lukaku nearly left Chelsea. And this was all a big scandal that blew out of proportion in a way, where Romelu Lukaku, in an interview with Sky Sports, said that, oh, he loved life in Italy and he would want to return to Inter Milan someday when his health condition is in his prime, essentially. And that has rattled a lot of Chelsea fans, saying that you shouldn't say that, mate. Why should you focus on Inter Milan right now when your priority should be Chelsea? And Thomas Tuchel has come out and said that these comments are not helpful at all. There's been a bit of a scuffle with Lukaku and the Chelsea fans, and eventually he's apologized and said that it's my bad, my apologies. I have to realign my commitments with the club right now and focus back on Chelsea. So all's not well over there. And that was showcased, interestingly enough, in Chelsea's heavyweight match against Liverpool, where Lukaku was dropped. Yeah, Romelu Lukaku, the front man of the Chelsea team. He's not quite happy with the new system that Chelsea are playing out with. And so he expressed his frustrations, and Thomas Tuchel also expressed his frustrations by dropping Lukaku eventually. But how was the match, you might be wondering? Oh my word, this was just marred in controversy. But this is what a proper heavyweight derby in the Premier League should look like. The result, 2-2. It was a proper street fight. Liverpool getting 2-0 up ahead, then Chelsea fighting back eventually with a really few big flashpoints. And if there's one match that you have to watch in this past week, it has to be this one. But the fact of the matter is, even though this might be an entertaining clash that just got you right down to the very end in terms of intensity, it does not matter because Manchester City now, in the matter of a couple of weeks, have eked out a 10-point gap at the top of the Premier League. They're on 53 points. Chelsea, with 21 games also, are on 43. They've only won one of their last five, can you believe it? There's probably a reason why things are just imploding in the Chelsea camp right now. Liverpool are, well, one game short, but even if they won that game, they would be 8 points behind Manchester City. So things are looking bright if you are a City fan. City fan? You can't be a City fan, can you? Yeah. But that aside, things are also a bit dramatic with City as well, because they had this really fun clash with Arsenal where the winner came in the 90th minute and stoppage time as Manchester City eked out a really solid win against Arsenal 2-1. They were the dominant team in this match, mind you. They had their control all over it, but Arsenal were plucky. And in relation to the first Man City versus Arsenal match of the season, they showed a lot more grit. And Bukayo Saka's goal troubled Man City for a very, very long time. But Gabriel got a red card later on. Rodri scored the winner very late on. Oh man, City weren't at their peak, but yeah, they eventually just got the win and now have solidified their 10-point gap, which is why the Premier League seems to be going to Manchester, but not to the red side. It's back to the blue again, but we could still see a lot of different stuff happening. If Chelsea have imploded so badly in the last week or two, maybe we could see City do the same as well. So it's not over yet. And in terms of United, best not to talk about it if you're a United fan, but another dismal performance against Wolverhampton Wanderers, losing 1-0. Spineless, lackluster, these are the kind of words that have been used for United in the last couple of weeks. And rightfully so, the team has had a new manager, and the new manager, Ralf Rangnick, seems to be flustered because the players aren't quite adapting to his system. So he's changed his system a couple of times as well. So it seems like United does not quite have a plan, and that's why they're languishing in the Premier League and languishing in terms of all the other results. They're just looking for inspiration and things don't work out that way. And that, folks, is our Premier League and football roundup in the world of European football. Oh yes, in Formula One, a brand new season begins this March and there might be some time to that, but there's a very interesting story that's going about in the world of F1 that could potentially transform the sport. Now, I've been saying this for, I think, around a month, that F1 is going to start a new era and a new generation of its racing. And you might be wondering, well, how exactly are they doing it? Well, Formula One has actually decided to introduce a brand new car for the year 2022. Long story short, I won't bore you with all the technical details because that's really going to get very dull for most of you. But it's a car that's designed to make for better racing. And it does that by making sure that cars can follow each other a little bit better. So it's a bold idea. It's something that Formula One has needed for a very, very long time because the cars of this generation are notoriously hard to follow. They just leave behind a lot of dirty air, which makes sure that the car behind just cannot quite get closer because they're so dependent on clean air to perform in their peak performance. So this is why the new car ideally should help. The simulations and the wind tunnels show that it is going to be effective. But again, we have to wait for them to come on track to get a proper idea if the cars are going to work out as well. But there's a catch. This car is longer than the current generation car, which is one thing that worries me quite a fair bit because the modern Formula One car is very wide. It's very long. It occupies a ton of track space. And even when you can follow it, you can't pass it. So that's one thing I'm very intrigued by. Is it too long this time out? That is something, of course, we get to know when the season begins in late March. But another new set of regulations are coming in parallelly along with this one. And these are the budget caps and the sliding scale aerodynamic regulations. So what's happened now is Formula One has recognized that at this current juncture, the teams are spending a lot. The top teams, that is. So say the likes of Ferrari, Mercedes, Red Bull Racing, they're easily going to around 350 million euros a year, sometimes even pushing 400 if you're Mercedes and another team that's in the championship fight. So used to be Ferrari, now it's Red Bull. So that is an outrageous amount of money to spend for a single season of Formula One racing, even though there's great marketing value. But what it does is it simply puts smaller teams like Haas and Williams and Alfa, not Alfa Tauri exactly, but say Alfa Romeo into a big troubling circumstance because they just can't compete. They don't really have that manufacture money with them. And so a budget cap of $125 million has been introduced, dollars that is, and it is going to be cut down every single year by a little bit for the next couple of years. And this is in short, basically, to make sure that the teams can operate in a certain budget zone so that the fight becomes more on how do you utilize your resources instead of how many resources you have. And this means that smaller teams could be competing potentially. This has led to a lot of staff being relocated, shifted out, the technical structures of the teams changing quite a fair bit. And this budget cap doesn't quite include the drivers, but a lot of the car development and the car manufacturing comes into this one. So teams are really under a proper constraint in 2022 to make sure that they can stay under this limit, firstly, and secondly, optimize it to get the best decisions. And along with this, there's another regulation that I mentioned, the sliding scale aerodynamic system, where the winning teams, the teams that finish higher up, are given a lower amount of simulation development and wind tunnel time, which means that, say, for instance, if you're Mercedes, who won the Constructors' Championship, they will be getting a proportionately lower amount of wind tunnel and development time in comparison to Haas, who finished right at the very end. And this is interesting. This means that throughout the season, these smaller teams or teams that didn't quite perform well in the past season have a better opportunity to develop their car and get back on track. So, logically and ideally, 2022 should be the closest Formula One season ever, but these are just concepts. We have to wait and see how they play out in the real world. And that is one of the biggest intriguing factors of the 2021 Formula One season that begins late in March this year.